This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
In this episode of the Book Club, Greg and I take a determined look at Dissolution from author C.J. Sansom, the first offering in the Shard Lake series, which was recently released as a TV show as well. The start to this episode has us in fits of laughter, as we had to do a couple of takes, which I have strategically removed, but kept in the giggles, just so you get a feel of the atmosphere as we engaged in our analysis. Thank you very much, Greg, as always. Two and a mic, clocking out. Enjoy.
Jepek kuduelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod joke mawoye tu under mic. Seche tim sud buta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed ping bi wawinji ero chako domomit ndi
tu and a mic
podcast makende.
I am so happy to say I'm joined once again by Greg, the book reviewer extraordinaire. How's it going, bud?
I'm very well. No pressure at all there.
No pressure at all. All right. Yeah, well, no, there can't be any pressure because we're looking at a book or a series of books you've been reading for 20 years. And that's how long it got you to get me to read it.
There's no lack of effort.
That's true. But yeah, do you want to, for those people who have not listened to the previous episode and so therefore haven't got a clue what book we're going to be looking at, and obviously you haven't read the title of this podcast because probably it's going to be in the name.
I think we're talking about Dissolution. As that seems to be what's happened to my mind.
Yeah, people don't understand why we're giggling here, but this is only the second take.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I'm not permitted to
if you ever have a bloopers reel at some point in the future.
Yeah, that might be on there.
Yeah.
It might be on there. Anyway, yeah, so exactly. We're talking about Shardley and Shardley, the TV show, Dissolution, the book by C.J. Sansom. And it's interesting for two reasons. First of all, because I think you bought the book Dissolution way back in 2003, more or less, when it was first released. And ever since then, you've been saying, Zach, you've got to get on this series. It's really good. It's comparable with Bernard Cornwell's Saxon Chronicles. It's not necessarily in the same vein, but it's comparable in the way that it develops that emotion, that sense of thrill of reading it, the pleasure and so on. And then obviously for some reason I never got onto it, but then one day sitting down on the sofa chilling out and I see boom, Shard Lake TV series is coming up pretty soon. So I got on the phone to you and you were like, oh cool, blah blah blah. So anyway, putting these two momentous occasions together, we decided that it's about time I read the first book and at the same time watch the TV series. So do you want to do a quick kind of background into the book, Dissolution, and what it's about and so on?
Yeah, so I mean, I think most importantly, the setting is probably as important as anything else. So it's set in around 1537. So Henry VIII's on the throne. It's shortly after Anne Boleyn has been found guilty of cheating on the king and therefore had to give up her own head.
As you did at the time.
The main protagonist is a lawyer who's called Matthew Shardlake, who's he seems to be a relatively well-to-do. He's an experienced and competent lawyer, but he's got what they keep calling him in the book a crook back, which means that he's certainly got some kind of illness or disease. His back is crooked and he can't stand straight, and only one of his arms works properly. So he's got a physical deformity, which it comes into play almost any time he has any interaction with anybody. So it's a strange juxtaposition whenever he's in a scene, because he has power of authority over those beneath him, and yet they still feel scorn for him for his physical deformity. And those who are above him and above his station are openly critical of him at every level, and including his deformity, call him Crookback instead of Matthew or Shardlake. Back in those days, they didn't have the sensitivities that we do now in using such terms. So that's the main protagonist. As I say, so we're now mid 16th sort of century England. Of course, in terms of the religion in England, we've come away from the Catholic Church. We've very much Brexited, as it were, which has caused no. I mean, it really did cause no end of trouble in terms of trade as well, because many routes and avenues of trade started to be closed to the UK, which we would otherwise have enjoyed. And so even things like opening up new trade routes to Turkey and the Ottoman Empire were things that were actively sought at the time, because it was difficult to do trade with the likes of Spain and France, our traditional trading partners, because of what was going on in the UK. If you did not follow the king, and subsequently later the queen who replaced the king, Queen Mary, and then Elizabeth, of course they changed back and forward between Protestantism and the Catholic religion, and back to Protestant under Elizabeth, and the public had to change with them, and whoever didn't change, and whoever continued to practice whatever they believed in, if it was against what the king or queen wanted, then they could find themselves in a spot of bother, which normally ended up with either losing your head or tied to a stake with some of the matches to hand.
Yeah, so not the best of times.
No, tricky.
Yeah, indeed. Taking a Dickensian term, at least. But yeah, so what's also interesting, though, is in this turn away from the Roman Catholic Church and away from recognizing the Pope as the sort of supreme, holy Catholicus of the Catholic Church, there is this then plan, or which comes about with two acts of Parliament, to essentially remove or dissolve all of the estates and institutions which are connected to the Roman Catholic Church. Now, this is something that I myself did not know about, and I don't think it's necessarily taught when you do GCSE history, at least it wasn't when I was taught it. So I found this to be quite an interesting part of the story, which is basically how the people who were quite influential within the king's court, and obviously the king himself, they basically tried to make a buck out of this process of dissolving all of these institutions. And in the end, though, a lot of the money that the king managed to gather was put into his war machine to fight the French.
Yes. Henry was pretty much bankrupt because he'd spent a lot of money fighting his wars. So he'd had a thing going on against France for a long time. He'd actually invaded into France earlier in the 16th century. He'd then reconciled, and with Francis I in the early 1520s, they'd had what was known as the Field of the Cloth of Gold, which had cost a small fortune in itself, where he'd taken his entire entourage with him to a place just outside Calais, where no expense had been spared in setting up tents, which were more like castles. Tents with windows, to give you an idea, in order to sort of prove themselves who was the greater king. Both of them spent enormous amounts of money. So at this point, where we are in the story, would be about 15 years later, Henry again needs to feed his war machine. And in order to do so, he's decided that quite easy to dissolve the 200 or so monasteries that exist up and down the UK, because these monasteries contain approximately 1/6 of the wealth of the country. So as you can see, it's an enormous amount of money for him, which he'd very much like to have that and stick it in his coffers so that he can go forth and cause trouble in Europe, particularly for the French.
Indeed. And so to be able to do that, then he needs to set a primary example. And so he embarks on this process of justifying this in the eyes of the people. So he has to get some dirt on this particular monastery. And it is here, where Chardelet comes in first. Chardelet comes into the second round of that particular operation, because the first couple of people who are sent in, one of them is actually killed. He's decapitated. Mm-hmm. And Chardelet is then sent in to try to establish who the hell dares kill the king's representative or investigator or commissioner or whatever the individual's role was at the time. And this is where essentially the story begins, that's where it begins, isn't it?
Yeah. Pretty much. Okay. I mean, so Chardelet has a meeting with Cromwell. Now, Cromwell, again, we should maybe introduce to the listeners in case some of them are not aware of him. Cromwell himself is a colourful character. He was born in South London. He wasn't of a noble family. In fact, his father was reasonably well-known tanner and also publican, but also a well-known brawler and drunk. So Thomas Cromwell's upbringing was a particularly tough one, and he wasn't unknown to physical violence meted on him by his own father. But he became quite a colourful character, Thomas Cromwell. He goes over to Europe and joins up with a few different armies and basically became a sellsword. He then ends up in Italy, penniless, but he's taken up by a banking family and works his way back to Northern Europe, learning along the way various different skills and picking up a number of European languages. So he comes back to the UK and becomes an MP, Thomas Cromwell, and through this sphere of influence ends up in the household of Cardinal Wolsey. Through his dealings with the cardinal, he ends up known to the king. And the king takes him on. He likes him very much. He takes him on and bestows upon him many, many titles through the 1530s. And some of them, he's Lord Great Chamberlain, Governor of the Isle of Wight, Lord Privy Seal, a Master of the Rolls, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. So you can see that the king really places his faith in him. And Chardelet goes to meet Lord Cromwell. So when he goes to meet him, this would have been at pretty much the height of Cromwell's power. So he understands that a person he's meeting is not to be taken lightly. So Cromwell says, and I just want to quote a little bit from the book. Cromwell says to Chardelet, "The skull of St. Barbara has been found in two different monasteries. Now, there are two-headed dragons in the Indies, but it appears that we have two-headed saints. I don't know who they were, but the caskets will be melted down like all the others, and the bones will go to the scrap heap. Men should not worship bones." So this is very much the kind of idea that was meted out at the time, which was that these idolatrous Catholics will pray to these idols, these various different bones of various saints and other pictures and paintings on which are put on walls. And the preeminent feeling at the time in the UK was that that shouldn't be the case, that everyone, you know, these great chunks of gold and useless decoration in churches is unnecessary, and we can do without those. So they go around trying to find reason to dissolve these monasteries and take away all their money and possessions.
Yeah. So, and this is where, as you say, so Chardelet, he walks in to Cromwell's office and is commissioned to carry out this particular role. He's also given an assistant to help him with the process, and they both trot off to
Scansey.
Where is it?
Scansey. I believe it's somewhere either Norfolk or Suffolk, probably Suffolk, for okay. because they mentioned the Fens at some point, so it might be somewhere near Suffolk.
Okay, so this monastery at Scansey. All right, so I mean, we don't want to give away too much by way of the specific storyline of how the story develops, but needless to say, it's a monastery. There's a certain hierarchy within the monastery. There are certain individuals who have influence in certain roles. There's also a town not too far from there, which is influenced by the work of the monastery. And there are different kinds of individuals involved. Different powers are involved. And the story kind of develops from there on. And it also talks about the abuse that some of the older monks would carry out on the younger monks. There's a certain question of homosexuality. There's a certain question of rape and the abuse of women and younger men as well. So all of this is played out and represented in different ways, or suggested at least in some parts within the story. Just a quick reference, as we kind of discussed before, because this is also a TV series, a four-part series. And when I was, so you've read the book, you also listened to an audio book. I listened only to the audio book, but I watched episode one of the TV series before I started the book. And episode one practically covered a third, if not more, of the book. Or at least this is my recollection of that. Just to point out how quickly the series moved in relation to the book. Did that disturb you at all? Or do you think that's just how it is nowadays because there are different audiences?
I think that the general speed of the book itself is set in, it's quite a sedate speed. I think that probably translates from Shardlake himself, who's a very considered man who doesn't do things in great haste. His movements are generally quite slow and ponderous, and he thinks things through, and he's constantly talking to you, the reader, and giving you insights into what his thoughts are. And I think that the first half of, particularly book one, is very much setting down who Shardlake is. So we get an idea of the center of Shardlake's world and the kind of man that we're dealing with. Generally, I believe we're led to believe that Shardlake is a kind and nice and honest person. And we're quite happy to be pulled along as the, you know, with him being the hero as such of the series. So I suspect that's why these things are probably, you know, in TV depicted very fast. People are willing to take things on face value on TV, which possibly they wouldn't do in a book. You're more likely to have things explained to you piecemeal in a book than you are in a TV program. That's my take of it.
Yeah. When I was going through the book, I did kind of get this sense of, as you say, it's a bit ponderous or pedestrian in some ways. It's very hard to compare this book to a modern crime thriller or any other kind of like a science fiction or fantasy story. And I'm just talking about the pace and not talking about the actual content or the plot. The pace of this is, I think, deliberately slow. I think Sanson wants the reader to step out of the rhythm of their current existence because it allows them perhaps to take on a better understanding of the times then. If you wanted to travel from one town to another, you didn't just jump into your car and roar off down a motorway at 100 miles an hour. You shouldn't do that now, to be honest. But anyway, you went there by, you got on a horse or you got a riverboat or whatever it was, depending on where you were. And it took time. And in the process of doing this, you were able to ruminate. You were able to make plans. You were able to strategize and so on. And this really comes into it, I think, as you say, with the introduction of the character, their thoughts, and they kind of guide you through what they believe their responsibilities to be. And I found that pacing a bit challenging at first, But you get used to it. Mm. It's fair to say. I know we're talking 21 years ago, so I don't think it's fair to say, oh, how did you feel 21 years ago? But now that you've gone back through it, did you feel that as well?
I probably didn't pick that up as much as you did, particularly when you compare it to the TV show, which is very easy to do, but it is probably worth doing. So when Chardonnay goes, let's say, from Scansey to back to London and back to Scansey again, not much of the journey is covered. You barely see him on a boat. Whereas when you're reading the book in a full version, when he's on the boat, things happen. He has conversations, he has discussions, he has his ideas. These things take up time and take up pages, which in the TV series, they hardly have a mention. So I think from that point of view, I can see how the pacing of the book is so much slower. And maybe that's why the TV series was felt that they couldn't really do that, because it would have gone on too long. Maybe that works much better for a TV series to have the pace speeded up a little.
Comparing again the show with the book, because that's a good way of talking about the story without giving away too many storylines. Are you happy with the diversion from the book that the TV series introduces? So there are one or two significant plot lines which end up being a little bit different. I also feel that they're introduced at different points. There is a different emphasis, perhaps, on some of these plot lines. The main one that comes to my mind is with Jack and Alice. We won't go into any detail because that's probably a bit unfair. But how did you feel about that? Do you think that it worked from your perspective?
I think it's been made the way it has in order for there to be a second series, perhaps. It makes it easier. So perhaps with that in mind, the changes that have been put into the TV show. So I can understand why. As to whether they work fully or not, I guess people will judge for themselves. I don't mind it. I've certainly seen much greater divergence between other books and TV series, which made a much bigger hole in the plot for me. But in this instance, I'm okay with it. And as I say, it allows for the characters to continue in a second series.
You've read a number of the other of later books in the Shard Lake book series. I haven't yet. I will do, though, because I'm interested in seeing how the character develops as per the author. Do you think there will be a season two?
I certainly hope so. So there, what we haven't heard at all as yet, of there are two or three very notable enemies that Shard Lake makes. One of whom is another lawyer who is, is on a level with Shard Lake, but doesn't have his deformities. And there's a very, very interesting interplay between those two. And then there's another one who's a real person. So we have Norfolk, who plays this kind of baddie part in the series here, the Duke of Norfolk. So Norfolk is superseded by another nobleman called Sir Richard Rich. Again, a real person. And he takes an instant dislike to Shard Lake. And their interplay and their storyline is a very important one in later books. So I'm sure if there are to be subsequent series, they would make an entrance and play a large part, because they make for very much interesting storylines, both of them.
Mm, okay, all right. How would you rate the book? A, from the perspective of historical drama, does it have a certain veracity to the storyline? How would you rate it as a detective series or novel? Does it tick the boxes that you would imagine a crime or detective novel should?
So, at the end of the TV series, you have the big reveal scene where everyone's brought together in a room and he puts forth his findings. The book doesn't quite end exactly the same way, but you do have that sense of Shard Lake bringing forward and putting his findings to those who are responsible and exacting, let's say, some justice, a meter of justice on those guilty. It not completely as we come to understand because of what happens at the end. I won't ruin it for anyone who wants to read it. And some of those are the differences we discussed between Jack Barrack's situation and Alice's. So in terms of a detective novel, we have a number of murders. It's not only one. And a couple of them are really quite brutal. So we have the investigation, the fact finding. He has many different, which we say, strands that he follows of evidence to try and find out who's been responsible for these crimes. And it's during this investigation that we get more and more information as to how a lawyer with these deformities that he has to tread in order to enable himself to meet the people who will give him the information he needs to solve the crime. So I think from that point of view, it as a whodunit, as a murder mystery novel, I think it does tick a lot of those boxes. But you know, I'm also mindful of the pace again, which you mentioned, which does set a meter that's much slower than many other detective novels that we read today. Not that that's in itself a bad thing. It's just I think as you mentioned, a device that the author has used in order to enable us to understand that the world in which Shardlake is inhabiting is a different one to the one that we have.
And what about with regards to the historical element to it? As in, as I said, for me, I had no knowledge whatsoever of these acts of parliament which introduced the dissolution of these monasteries and other religious institutions. So for me, it was quite educational to go in then to the histories and say, oh shit, this really happened. Did you feel that was presented also in a good way? Would you say that, yeah, there's a certain level of reliability with this historical note?
Again, so here I think is where the book does more than the series does. In the series, you don't really get that level because it hasn't got the same level. You don't get the level of interactions that Shardlake has with different types of people. So those who we would say are beneath him. Oh, you do have the whole interplay between Alice and Barrack, where Shardlake is trying to discourage a relationship between them because he feels that she is beneath his stations and the two of them should not have a relationship with one another. So you do get a sense of that in the plot of the show, but that's much more developed in the book itself. So those sorts of things, and also the interaction between Shardlake, Cromwell, Shardlake, Norfolk. So these people who are above Shardlake station and the intricacies that he has to deal with in order to get information from them, which is very different to the way that he'll speak to, let's say, a jailer or a guard who is beneath him. He just has to show him the king's seal or the letter that he's got and demand information from them. So Shardlake has this path to tread throughout the story. And depending on who, you know, which person is encountering, it's an interesting game he has to play in order to ensure that he's getting what he needs to from the various different people that he encounters.
While we're on the subject of historical veracity, it's important, I think, to introduce the topic of Anne Boleyn. Sansom puts across his thoughts on the character that was Anne Boleyn. Different historians over the years have had a different view. The criticisms for which she was unjustly, unlawfully beheaded are very much pushed back, I feel, by the author. He clearly believes that this was just a pile of bullshit that Henry put together because, yeah, he got bored, he wanted somebody else. And to be able to justify that, he had to come up with this rubbish about her having had an affair. And once again, it goes back to the misrepresentation, the abuse of women throughout history, which unfortunately continues on until today, as we've seen from a recent very tragic occurrences in the UK and among other places. Are you convinced by Sansom's argument with regards to Anne Boleyn? And before having read the book, did you have any thoughts on that anyway yourself?
With the Anne Boleyn situation, what we sort of all we knew of Anne Boleyn is that she kind of teased the king into marrying her. She refused to go to bed with him until she was convinced that he would marry her. Either he had married her or that she was convinced that he would marry her. So it was a very intricate game she played with Henry to keep him interested, but only that until she managed to hook him. So I suspect at some point the king either grew bored of her because she was, you know, very much his junior in age, possibly wasn't as erudite as he probably needed her to be, didn't entertain him in other ways apart from the obvious. And for some reason, one reason or another, he got bored of her and needed to find a way out of that relationship. Now, we know that he was prepared to pull the country out of the religion that he held very dearly up until that point in order to annul his first marriage. And at this point, he probably felt powerful enough that he could do anything he wanted. So if he needed to find a way out of that marriage, and if it suited certain individuals within his own staff, i.e. people like Cromwell and Singleton and Norfolk or whoever else might, Norfolk wouldn't have been involved in obviously, but other members of his Privy Council may well have helped find a way for him to get out of it by creating a story which would allow him to accuse these two people of treason and have them beheaded. And once it was done, it was done. Of course, being a king and being all powerful means you can get away with pretty much anything you want, but having people around you means that they can sometimes get what they want done by convincing you of certain things. We know this, for example, by his marriage to Anne of Cleves was famously on the back of a portrait that was painted of her by Hans Holbein, who was the court painter. But Hans Holbein was very much of a mind that he wanted the king to marry a very strict Protestant girl, and so the portrait that he painted of Anne of Cleves was a particularly sympathetic portrait, okay, of Anne of Cleves. So when he saw the picture, the king was very interested to meet this lady and marry her, so all the documents were drawn up as to how much money would be coming with her and such. And then when he met her, he realized she didn't look very much like the portrait at all, and so refused to consummate the marriage. And he insisted that he was unable to bed her, and therefore the marriage should be null and void. And instead, he gave her a very generous stipend and castles in England to not marry him as such, or not to remain married to him.
Fair enough, which, to be honest, is probably the best way to go. And judging by the portraits of Henry VIII, I mean, he's not much of a looker himself, is he? But anyway.
Not the ones you're thinking of, but at that point later in his life, he was obviously quite a portly individual. In his youth, he was considered a very good-looking, charming and energetic prince. He would lead his soldiers into battle. If there were trials, for example, jousting, he would do whatever he could to ensure that he himself would enter the trials, the joust. So the individual that we see later is very different to the king who, you know, when he first came to the throne, he was a very different sort of stature.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I don't mean physically, I mean his face. I mean, I don't know how accurate any of these portraits are of the faces, but yeah, he doesn't strike me as a particularly attractive chap. But yeah, anyway. Beauty.
Amazing how good a crown looks on. How good a crown looks on you.
I tell you. Yeah, true. If the title of king in those days carried a certain weight to it, as good as gold, really, you could say, in many ways. Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Any other points that you'd like to raise? Because I'm pretty much out of questions with regards to this one. I will, as I said, read book two. But as far as our book series goes, I would say this probably comes in at the lower end of my enjoyment scale, even though I liked it, but it took me a bit to get into it, to like it, if you know what I mean, because of the pace. And that's more me rather than the book, and I accept that. But I would need to read another book, and I will do, because I think it's good enough to get that.
I think you'll find that the pace quickens on the next books. I think the very first book, as often is the case with these things, the author is trying to not just establish the character and the characters around him, but the world in which he inhabits. And that, as you say, the first half of the book is taken up with that. So the pace probably took you a little by surprise because of that. I think if you read the second and third books, it, to my mind, from what I remember, they are a little bit more to the pace that you might enjoy. So, but I would definitely suggest you give that a go.
Yeah, I will do. I will do. It's just I often recall book one of Bernard Cornwell's Saxon Chronicles, and that just grabbed me from chapter one. I don't know if it's just the voice of Uhtred in that particular story and the way Uhtred spoke as a character. I don't know, but there's something about that which just grabbed me straight away.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Uhtred, I mean, the thing is that Uhtred is that kind of character, isn't he? So he could just go charge off on his horse and go and start chopping people up. You're not going to get that with Shard Lake. That's not how he works. So, yeah. Where Uhtred seems almost inviolable, almost untouchable, you know, you never have a serious thought that Uhtred's going to die. Even when he's in real dire situations, Uhtred, you just think, okay, he's going to come out of it somehow. With Shard Lake, he's obviously, by necessity, always in more danger because the world in which he inhabits, there are many people above him, above his station, who have the power and the means to do him harm. Many more so than Uhtred. Uhtred doesn't really give a damn. I mean, he would deal, you know, he'd deal, even when he's dealing with King Alfred, he's very much openly speaking his mind and saying things which might get other people into terrible trouble, but he gets away with it because he's Uhtred.
Yeah. But also, I mean, it's not just because of Uhtred, as you say, you know, he just jumps on a horse and goes apeshit. But I think his character is also portrayed in a very intelligent, witty way. And I really love the dialogue in the Saxon Chronicles. I think the dialogue is fantastic. It's not quite Oscar Wilde, but it's still brilliant. And I think that's perhaps a step above what I've read so far in book one.
Well, I mean, I think what I love most about the Saxon Chronicles and about Uhtred's character and the way it's written is that he often finds himself in situations where he's dealing with another lord or a lordling or one of these people who may be a little beneath him or on at the same level as Uhtred, but by no means would they be have his level of experience or fighting prowess. And he never tells them who he is until he has to. So they often see him as an older man. So they, you know, they the old timers stand aside or you know, I should do this and that to you. And eventually some other character explains to them the error of their ways, or they actually try to do something, at which point he smashes them aside. And then, you know, once he's overpowered them, tells them who he is. At that point, they start groveling. You get a lot of that with Uhtred. You're not going to get that with Shard Lake.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Cool. Okay, so would you recommend, this is a bit of a silly question considering the introduction, because you've been recommending this to me for 20 years, but if you were to speak with somebody else who had a slight interest in reading books, would you recommend Shard Lake to them on the basis of being a historical detective book?
I would. I think the story holds enough nuance, and I think it's very well told. It does have that the elements of whodunit of a murder mystery with a detective person in the form of Shard Lake to solve that. And enough things go on in this novel to hold my interest. I would certainly say that. And I think it makes a good introduction into the Shard Lake series, and the subsequent books, I think, develop the character a lot better. And there's a lot more goes on, as I say, with more, should we say, enemies for Shard Lake to deal with, which actually puts him more at peril, which I never really felt that peril was felt in this first book, and certainly not in the TV series, apart from one moment where he gets racked. But, you know, apart from that, you don't really feel that he's in any peril himself. In later books, yeah. He very much is.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that might add a bit of tension to the storyline, because, as you say, most of the time in this first part, he was kind of surrounded by monks who were always trying to show how peaceful they are. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, that danger didn't exist. Okay, cool. Good. All right. So an enjoyable book. slow paced, but kind of gets there in the end. And more to come from book two. So thank you. As in, I agree that it definitely deserves a run through, and I will go further into the series. It's my turn now to recommend a book for the next episode. And when I was perusing the list of audiobooks in my catalog, I came across a book called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum by Emma Southern. And I've already listened to it, but I'm going to have to do it again because I just found it amazing. So I know you love Roman history. You studied it in addition to ancient Greek history. So this is right up your alley.
Thank you.
And definitely something that
in the Blackadder sense.
In the Blackadder sense or any other sense. something you're very much going to enjoy, I think.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Time shall tell. I'm sure I will. Let's hope so.
Yeah, definitely. And there are going to be a lot of Cicero references in our next episode. But anyway, Greg, thank you very much. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I will try to resist the temptation of adding in a blooper here and there. I promise I will do my best to do that. Please be kind if I fail.
No, I'm sure you can do it. It's not hard.
Okay. All right. I will. Thanks again. And until next time.
Thank you. Until next time.
Two and a mic. And a mic.